Welcome to the online ministry of La Jolla United Methodist Church, a congregation of faithful Christians along the beautiful Southern California coast. Together we seek to grow in individual spirituality and in community with one another. All are invited to join in this vibrant faith community. More information can be found on our website at lajoyaunitedmethodist.org. May you be enriched in the hearing of these words, and may you receive and enjoy God's blessing.
Our scripture reading this morning is from the book of John, chapter 18, verses 1 through 11. After he said these things, Jesus went out with his disciples and crossed over to the other side of the Kidron Valley. He and his disciples entered a garden there. Judas, his betrayer, also knew the place because Jesus often gathered there with his disciples. Judas brought a company of soldiers and some guards from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They came there carrying lanterns, torches, and weapons. Jesus knew everything that was to happen to him, so he went out and asked, "Who are you looking for?" They answered, "Jesus the Nazarene." Excuse me. He said to them, "I am." Judas, his betrayer, was standing with them. When he said, "I am," they shrank back and fell to the ground. He asked them again, "Who are you looking for?" They said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you, I am. If you are looking for me, then let these people go." This was so that the word he had spoken might be fulfilled. "I didn't lose anyone of those whom you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus told Peter, "Put your sword away. Am I not to drink the cup the Father has given me?"
You know, when I was growing up, there were really only two poems that my dad would say on a regular basis. One, like, I don't even understand how it works this way, except that God has a sense of humor. One, my youngest son, Zachary, just threw out at me randomly this morning. It goes like this. "Moses supposes his toeses are roses. But Moses supposes erroneously. For no one supposes their toeses are roses as Moses supposes his toeses to be." You can laugh. It's okay. That was meant to be funny. Either that or maybe I'm just not that funny. I don't know. The other poem that my dad would often recite portions of is Thomas Hardy's In the Servants' Quarters. If you don't know this poem, it is a poem about Peter denying Jesus. We're going to get to that poem, and I have a special guest who's going to read it for us. I'm super excited for it, and it's going to be sort of the midpoint in our story. You see, I feel like even though we're nearing the end of Lent, really this is the midpoint of our story. I feel like we should recap a little bit. And you know, honoring some of my preacher friends who remember that the way we're taught to preach is, I wasn't taught to preach this way, but others have been. You tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. So we're at that midpoint. I want to remind you that at the first Sunday of Lent, we talked about Palm Sunday. I remember there may have been a bit of anxiety. I said, "Don't worry, we're still going to do Palm Sunday the week before Easter." And we are. But also we're doing Passion Sunday. So we started on Palm Sunday. Then the next Sunday, Pastor Leah preached about righteousness and Jesus turning over the tables in the temple. We talked the following Sunday about Jesus teaching in the temple and the ways that he was challenged by the religious elite, by the religious leaders, and the ways he responded to that challenge. Then we talked about Jesus being anointed by perhaps an unnamed woman. Perhaps it was Mary Magdalene. Perhaps it was Mary, the sister of Martha, depending on which gospel you read. Then last Sunday, we talked about Jesus gathering with his disciples at the Last Supper and the critical importance of celebrating Holy Communion. And we ended last Sunday in the garden with Jesus praying. So here we are on Palm Sunday, on Passion Sunday. And we know what's next. But maybe we don't want to go through the details. Because the details are kind of ugly. The details might bring us sorrow, grief. And as I said during our time of prayer, we may want to just skip this part. Let's go straight to the Easter eggs and the bunny. And I would suggest, my friends, that that would not do us service. As we've been taking this journey through Lent, really in a lot of ways looking at each day of Holy Week, taking a week to do so, we've been guided by a book by Amy Jill Levine, The Passion of Christ. I think it was Entering the Passion of Christ. I left the book in my office, I'm sorry. Entering the Passion of Jesus. It's good that Pastor Lee is here to keep me on track. I confess to you, though, that I've used another book as a source. You already know that I like Marcus Borg. There's a book by Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan called The Last Week. I've been using that as a source as well. And the reason I say that is because I want to look at the remainder of the story following the text that was read today, following the prayer in Gethsemane. And I'll use a little bit more the Gospel of Mark than the Gospel of John. One of the things I've said before that I love about the Gospel of Mark is it's short. It's the shortest gospel. But also the way Mark structures this Good Friday text is easy for me to understand. See, Mark boils it down into three-hour blocks. And so after Jesus is arrested in the garden, he is taken to Pilate. Now, we talked at the beginning of Lent about sort of where things are geographically in Jerusalem. So there's the temple where there are sort of the court of the Gentiles on the outside, and then there's a couple of inner courts. There's a court for women, there's a court for men, and then there's the Holy of Holies. You may remember that there's a giant tapestry that's hung in the Holy of Holies that separates the innermost place where God is thought to be perhaps best experienced. And the only person ever allowed in there is the high priest. There's only one of them. And the high priest is only allowed in there once a year. Now, Jesus comes in riding on Palm Sunday. He comes in from the east. And we talked on the first Sunday about perhaps the tradition of the Roman governors was to come in from the west, right? We talked about sort of the contrast between these two processions, one of power and one of humility. So we might imagine that if Pilate followed that tradition, he came in from the west, likely with lots of soldiers and things, and then went to take up a residence in the fortress Antony, which is sort of on the northwest corner of the temple. Well, when Jesus is arrested, it seems likely that that's where he would go to be questioned by Pilate, on this northwest corner of the temple. This happens, according to the Gospel of Mark, at daybreak. And it's not only Pilate there. There's the chief priests, the elders, the legal experts, the whole Sanhedrin. And they'd made a plan. Well, Pilate asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus replies, "That's what you say." I really like the way Jesus' question in the garden as it was read in the Gospel of John. I like Jesus' response. He says, "I am." And I understand why the soldiers fell. Because I wonder if they understood that that's exactly what God said speaking out of a burning bush when Moses said, "Who are you?" "I am." Well, in the Gospel of Mark, when Jesus is questioned by Pilate, he replies, "That's what you say." And what's remarkable is Pilate, this person of remarkable power, can't get Jesus to answer after that. Can you imagine being questioned by the person with the most power in the world? And you just don't answer? This is what happens. I imagine Pilate was even more surprised than anyone. Now, the thing that follows in the Gospel of Mark is that there's a story about Pilate releasing a prisoner. I don't know how much extra biblical research you do, maybe not a lot. It appears, at least from my research, and if you know something different, please tell me. It appears, at least from my research, that there is no extra biblical, in other words, outside of sacred text. I'm talking Josephus, others. There is no extra biblical writing that there is a tradition of letting a prisoner go at the Passover. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying it's not supported elsewhere. It's not written elsewhere. Let's move on with the idea that this is what happens. And then a man named Barabbas is chosen instead. But how does the crowd respond? When Pilate says, well, what should we do with this one who is called the King of the Jews? Do you remember how they respond? Crucify him. Now, some preachers, and I may have been guilty of this previously, some preachers might say, well, listen, it's really interesting to go from the crowds who would first shout Hosanna and perhaps the same crowds who would shout crucify. You know, in my study, I'm beginning to question whether I was right about that. I wonder if those chief priests and elders and legal experts were at the door checking IDs. You can't come in. You like Jesus. What was the whole point of the betrayal? To separate Jesus from the crowds because they were afraid of the crowds. I wonder if they only let their folks in when it came time to select who would be released and what would happen with the one called king. Pilate said to them, why? What wrong has he done? They shouted even louder, crucify him. And Pilate, too, seems as though he may have been afraid of the crowd. He released Barabbas and had Jesus whipped and handed him over to be crucified. Now, it is during this trial, not in the Gospel of Mark, but we certainly find it in the Gospel of John, that Jesus, while being questioned, maybe just one or two of his followers are nearby. We remember the story of Jesus being denied by Peter. And I wonder if you might hear this poem by Thomas Hardy. I'd like to introduce my special guest by video. He pre-recorded this for us. This is my dad, Jerry. And I'd like you to hear. My dad is an actor by trade. He worked in Hollywood for a long time, behind the camera doing lighting, but I would say he's an actor first. Here now, we've got a video on the screen, and I hope you'll be able to hear it as well. Here in the Servants' Quarters by Thomas Hardy.
Man, you too, aren't you? One of those rough followers of the criminal? All hanging here about together how he's going to bear examination in the hall? She flung disdainful glances on the shabby figure standing at the fire, with others there who warmed them by its flare. No, indeed, my skipping maiden, I know nothing of the trial here, or criminal, if so he be. I chanced to come this way, and the fire shone out into the dawn, and morning airs are cold now. I, too, was drawn in part by charms I see before me play that I see not every day. Ha-ha, then laughed the constables, who also stood to warm themselves. The while another maiden scrutinized his features hard, as the blaze threw into contrast every line and knot that wrinkled them, exclaiming, "Why, last night when he was brought in by the guard, you were with him in the yard." "Nay, nay, you teasing wench, I say, you know you speak mistakenly. Cannot a tired pedestrian, who has footed it afar, here on his way from northern parts, engrossed in humble marketings, come in and rest a while, although judicial doings are afoot by morning star?" "Oh, come, come," laughed the constables. "Why, man, you speak the dialect he uses in his answers. You can hear him up the stairs. So on it, we shan't hurt ye. There, he's speaking now. His syllables are those you sound yourself when you are talking unawares, as this pretty girl declares. And you shudder when his chain clinks," she rejoined. "Oh, yes, I noticed it. And you wince, too, when those cuffs they gave him echo to us here. They'll soon be coming down, and you may then have to defend yourself, unless you hold your tongue, or go away and keep you clear when he's led to judgment near." "No, I'll be damned in hell if I know anything about the man. No single thing about him more than everybody knows. Must not I even warm my hands, but I am charged with blasphemies?" His face convulses as the morning cock that moment crows, and he stops and turns and goes.
It is after Jesus is questioned, after he is denied, and after the crowds shout to crucify, crucify, that he is released to soldiers who lead him away into the palace known as the governor's headquarters. They dress him up in a purple robe. They place a crown of thorns on his head. They salute him. "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they beat him about the head. We know that head lacerations bleed. They spit on him. They kneel before him in mock honor. And then they strip him of the robe. They put his clothes back on him. And they lead him out to crucify him. My understanding of the practice of Roman crucifixion, particularly around Jerusalem, is that the upright portion of the cross may have been left in place, and it was the crossbar that a person would be forced to carry, which doesn't really make it any lighter. But you see, there were enough crucifixions. Why dig and bury the foot of the cross every time? See, it's a matter of efficiency. And we often think of that cross as something elevated, 10, 12, 15 feet in the air. At least according to Borg and Crossan. Imagine that it's just high enough to keep the one being crucified from being able to reach the ground. Surely it would be on an elevated place, but for those who were close enough, can you imagine looking at the one being crucified directly in the eye? Can you imagine the charges placed on the cross? In the case of Jesus, the King of the Jews. Well, since it began at daybreak, probably around 6 a.m., all of this questioning and torture before he is brought out to the cross And according to Mark, it was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. People walked by, insulted him, shaking their heads and saying, "Ha! You were going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, were you? Save yourself and come down from that cross." Can you imagine that mocking? Maybe not looking so high as we would have imagined, but looking him in the eye, seeing him with the crown on his head, having been beaten with a stick. The chief priests were making fun of him among themselves, together with the legal experts. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross. Then we'll see and believe." Even those who had been crucified with Jesus insulted him. See, in the Gospel of Mark, it doesn't tell us much about those who were crucified with him. So Jesus was crucified at 9, endured hours of insult. And then from noon until 3 in the afternoon, the whole earth was dark. I honestly don't know if there was a supernatural event or an eclipse or something that caused the earth to be dark for 3 hours, or if it was a time of unimaginable grief. I know when I have felt so stricken with grief, it has felt as though the whole world was dark. At 3, Jesus cried out with a loud shout, "Eloi! Eloi! Lama sabachthani? My God, my God, why have you left me?" Some standing there said, "Look, he's calling Elijah." Someone filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a pole, and offered it to him, saying, "Let's see if Elijah will come down and take him." But Jesus let out a loud cry and died. The curtain in the sanctuary was torn in two from top to bottom. When a centurion who stood facing Jesus saw how he died, he said, "This man was certainly God's son." Do we understand the importance of that sentence, my friends? This is the first time in the Gospel of Mark that Jesus has been identified as God's son. And who does it? It's an outsider. Since it was late in the afternoon on preparation day just before the Sabbath, Joseph from Arimathea asked for Jesus' body. Pilate wanted to make sure that Jesus was dead before giving the body to Joseph. And so he did. And Pilate gave the body to Joseph, who bought a linen cloth, took Jesus down from the cross, wrapped him in the cloth, and laid him in a tomb that had been carved out of a rock. He rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Jesus, saw where he was buried. It's interesting that in the Gospel of Mark, we see about Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Jesus. I was thinking about Mary, the mother of Jesus, who is the only person in our sacred text that we read who was there at the birth of Jesus and at his death. It's interesting to me that Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Jesus, are there, but at least in the Gospel of Mark, none of the 12 are anywhere to be found. This is where we leave ourselves on this Passion Sunday. I always like to preach, leaving some element of hope at the end of a message. And as we are here on Passion Sunday, I feel that temptation once again. And yet I suggest that our temptation to avoid the difficult things does us harm. And instead, we might sit in this space of grief, of wonder, of questions, of discomfort. Because I believe that it is in times of questions and wonder that we might be transformed. Let us, my friends, acknowledge the grief and wonder and prepare ourselves for transformation. For it is when a seed falls to the ground and dies that it bears much fruit.